One of my favourite old-time preachers was a chap called Alan Redpath, and I've often given you a quote from his that I want to start with this morning. He said, "The conversion of a soul is the miracle of a moment. People come to faith instantly when we cry out to God, when we call upon his name. Oh God, come into my life, be merciful to me, turn me around, change me. The conversion of a soul is the miracle of a moment. But the manufacture of a saint is the task of a lifetime. The manufacture of a saint is the task of a lifetime." When someone becomes a Christian, that's not the end, it's the beginning of a brand new journey, a journey of faith with Jesus Christ, the Saviour of Lord. And that takes time. There are no shortcuts to maturity. The Russian comedian Yakov Smirnov said when he first came to America, he was amazed by the variety of instant products. He'd never seen anything like it back home in Russia. On his first shopping trip, he said, "I saw powdered milk. You just add water and you get milk. Then I saw powdered orange juice. Again, you add water and you get orange juice." He said, "Then I saw baby powder. And I thought to myself, what a country! What a country!" We're used to instant products, aren't we? From instant potato. Do you remember those of certain generations? Mash means smash, and the robots. Instant coffee. Instant. When it comes to being a disciple, a follower of Jesus, there are no instant mature Christians. It is a daily learning process, a weekly growing. And before we look at the four pictures that 2 Timothy uses to describe what does it mean to be a disciple, 2 things by way of introduction. 2 basic things, really. First of all, he reminds us that a disciple is someone who has come to faith, that is, been converted. That's where discipleship starts. A disciple is not a church attender, though that is good. A disciple is not a Bible reader, though that is good. Or even one who prays. All those things are important and have their place. But a disciple is one who has come to faith. This letter, 2 Timothy, was written, surprise to surprise, to a man called Timothy. Timothy was the pastor of a local church. And in the previous chapter, chapter 1 and verse 5, Paul uses this little expression. "I am reminded of your sincere faith, which first lived in your grandmother Lois and in your mother Eunice, and I am persuaded now lives in you also." Timothy had an advantage in life that I, for one, didn't have. He had people in his family who were Christians, followers of Jesus. And so they took the time to pray for him and to read the scriptures to him and to help him come to his own faith. Now, they planted the seed, but he wasn't converted until the Apostle Paul came along. And either by what he preached or by his influence, he helped Timothy come to faith. And we know that because we're told that in 1 Timothy. And the important bit is this: he heard or he saw the example of his parents, his mother and his grandmother. And then there came a time in his inexperience when he said, "Lord, make it real to me." He got converted. He became a Christian. And of course, our influence upon our children is so important, isn't it? Billy Graham, the great preacher, put it this way: children will invariably talk, eat, walk, think, respond, and act like their parents. Give them a target to shoot at. Give them a goal to work toward. Give them a pattern that they can see clearly, and you give them something gold and silver cannot buy. Well, Timothy's mother and grandmother gave him something money could not buy. A godly example of a real lived out faith. And in his own time, Timothy responded to what he saw and what he heard, and he got converted. He became a Christian. And secondly, we're told, and I guess it's one of the evidences we've come to faith, he wanted to share that experience with others. What we call evangelism. It lived in you. I've entrusted this to you. Now you entrust it. You go and share it with other people. Go and tell them the good news of Jesus. And at our very first seminar, our very first sermon, way back, that David took on the Great Commission, He reminded us the call to discipleship. Jesus said to his followers, now you go. I'm going away, but you go and share this message with those you encounter. Go into all the world and make disciples of all nations. Last weekend we were listening to Roger Carswell, a preacher, and he shared this story. He said a true story of a teacher he knew up in Leeds. And when he went to school on the Monday morning, one of the pupils said to him, sir, what have you been doing over the weekend? And the teacher said, oh, you wouldn't be interested. Let's carry on. No, sir. What did you do? He said, no, you wouldn't be interested, honest. Oh, please, sir, tell us what you did. Well, he said, well, myself and a group of Christians, we went out into the city centre and we did some evangelism. We shared some leaflets with people who would take them and we spoke to them about Jesus. And the lad said, no, you didn't. And the teacher said, we did. No, you didn't. What did you really do, sir? He said, well, a group of us from our church, we went to the city centre, we gave out some leaflets, and we shared a little bit about what Christians believe. And the boy said, no, you did. He said, we did. And then the lad said, sir, next time you go out and do some vandalism, can we come? It wasn't vandalism, evangelism. Sharing our faith. Timothy did that. Paul entrusted the message to him. He entrusted it to others. They entrusted it to others. And so the chain goes on. And of course the reason in our country we're able to enjoy the Christianity is because people came to this country and shared the message with us. One thing Christianity isn't, and that is Western. Came from Israel, the land of the book. So a disciple is someone who comes to faith, someone who has a desire to share that faith with others. And the apostle here uses four pictures of what a disciple is. First of all, he says, a soldier. Endure hardship like a good soldier of Jesus Christ. One of my heroes is a chap called David Livingstone, famous missionary and explorer. I don't think anyone has achieved what Livingstone did just as an explorer. And when you think that, the church in Africa owes so much to him as an individual, as a missionary. An incredible man. If you've never read his biography, his life story, get it and read it. But after some time when he was in Africa, and he went as a lone missionary, he went on his own, left wife, children behind. The missions committee back home wrote to him. And they wrote these words. Some people would like to join you. What is the easiest road to where you are? Livingstone replied, if they're looking for the easiest road, tell them to stay in England. I want people to come even if there is no road at all. I think Livingstone realised that often the Christian pathway is not an easy one, it is a difficult one. It is not smooth tarmac, it is an uphill, rocky struggle. And that's why the Apostle Paul said, endure hardship. When someone joins the army, they give up a cushy life. They enter a life of discipline. They're on active service. They put their lives in danger. And for the Christian, it's similar. We are in dangerous situations. The great American evangelist, D.L. Moody, he was the Billy Graham of his day in the 1800s. He preached to thousands of people. He had a song leader called Ira Sankey. Some of you know, in this church for many years, we had a hymn book called Sankey's Hymns. And when Moody preached, Ira Sankey would sing a solo and they would use the hymns collectively in the congregations. There was one song Ira Sankey was not allowed to sing. D.L. Moody said, you can sing all the hymns in your book apart from this one. We're not having it. And it was the song Onward, Christian Soldiers. And if you know the hymn, you might think, but hold on, what? It's not got any bad theology in it. Why can't we sing Onward, Christian Soldiers? And Moody wouldn't sing it because he said, the church that I know is anything but a military operation. So many followers are lukewarm, half committed, no discipline, no commitment. We can't sing it. In fact, someone did a parody on it called Backward Christian Soldiers. Here's how it goes. Backward Christian soldiers fleeing from the fight, with the cross of Jesus nearly out of sight. Christ our rightful master stands against the foe, but forward into battle we are loath to go. Like a mighty tortoise moves the church of God. Brothers, we are travelling where we've always trod. We are much divided, many bodies we, having many doctrines, but not much charity. Crown and thorns may perish, kingdoms rise and wane, but the church of Jesus hidden does remain. Gates of hell should never against that church prevail. We have Christ's own promise, but think that it will fail. Sit here then, ye people, join our useless throng. Blend with ears your voices in a feeble song. Blessings, ease and comfort, ask from Christ the King. With our modern thinking, we don't do a thing. Well, it's not a new problem for the church. In the 1800s, Moody said, we're not singing on with Christian soldiers, not with the apathy that dominates so many Christians. Paul says, endure hardship. It is a disciplined life to follow Jesus. It takes commitment. You are going against the flow. The society we live in is going that way and you are going that way. We don't agree with people on their values regarding money or sex or a whole host of things. We're going against the tide. So expect to get some persecution. Expect to get some flak. That's what it means. Endure hardship like a good soldier. No soldier gets involved in civilian affairs. When you joined the Roman army, you made a sacramentum. You made a pledge of allegiance to Caesar. You bowed down before him. And I suppose it's the equivalent of what happened in this country when you took the king's shilling when you enlisted in the army. And as you made your public pledge to the emperor, you were saying, I am no longer in charge of my life. You are. I'm joining your ranks. Same as when someone joins the army. You put yourself under another authority. They will tell you when to get up in the morning. The army will tell you what to wear. They will tell you where to go, what to eat, and who to shoot. And you follow because you're under a new authority. And in Bible days, they took a sacramentum, a promise to the emperor. We will live for you. We will serve you. And Paul says, in the same way, we make a sacramentum to the king. We say, Jesus, you are our Lord. What you say goes. We will follow you. So the first bit is endure hardship. The second picture is that of an athlete. Verse 5. If anyone competes as an athlete, he does not receive the victor's crown unless he competes according to the rules. Here the emphasis is on honesty, fairness. Compete as an athlete. I suppose until Lance Armstrong recently, the biggest sporting cheat in my lifetime was a chap called Ben Johnson, a Canadian athlete. In the 1988 Olympic Games, the whole world was shocked. There was a prime time race. Everybody wanted to see it. Ben Johnson against Carl Lewis. Carl Lewis was the record holder, the world record holder. Ben Johnson was a frustrated athlete who was fed up coming second. He had to beat him. And this was his moment. This was his time. This Olympic race. Halfway through the race, to everyone's amazement, Johnson was 5 feet ahead of Carl Lewis. Unheard of. Lewis thought, I'll catch him. I always do. But he never did. As Johnson went over the line, Lewis was still 5 feet away from him. Johnson turned around to Lewis, raised his fist and gave him a one-fingered salute. Refused to shake his hand. This was his moment. I've waited for this. Your history. Hours later, the world was shocked when Johnson failed his drug test. A cheat. Stripped of his medal. And it went to Carl Lewis, who finished second. The Apostle Paul says, what is the point of winning if you've cheated? If you've cheated. What is the point of outwardly looking the part, but inwardly being a fraud? Don't do it. Honesty, character in the Christian is important. Is important. I did read about the story of Grandpa who was going on to his family about the good old days. You know, in the good old days, you know what? You go to the shops, you get 6 oranges, 2 loaves of bread, a magazine and a pair of jeans, all for half a crown. And then he said, with a smile on his face, you can't do that anymore because they have security cameras. Honesty. Paul wants us to be genuine, honest. Here's the third picture. The farmer. The hard-working farmer should be first to receive a share of the crops. Reflect on what I'm saying, for the Lord will give you insight into all of this. Again, I love the old joke of the farmer who was desperate for a wife. You probably know it. So he wrote to the Lonely Hearts column and he put this advert in. Farmer seeks wife with tractor. Please send picture of tractor. Farming is an image the Apostle Paul uses on numerous occasions. It's a great source of illustrations for him. And what he reminds us here is this, that a farmer needs patience. A soldier has to endure hardship. An athlete needs to be honest and play by the rules. But a farmer has to work hard. Patience. Patience. Anne Mansfield Sullivan had a host of folks telling her that the 7-year-old brat she was teaching was not worth it. But she persisted despite temper tantrums, physical abuse, mealtime madness, even thankless parents. In her heart, Anne Mansfield Sullivan knew it was worth the pain. Within 2 years, that child was able to read and write in Braille. She ultimately went on to graduate from Radcliffe College, where Anne Sullivan spelt every lecture into her hand by touch. The name of that pupil, of course, the spoilt brat, was Helen Keller, who then went on herself to devote her life to aiding the deaf and blind people. Anne Mansfield Sullivan, incredible patience, and yet it reaped incredible rewards. Paul says every farmer has to be patient. And if he is, the crops follow. The crops follow. But there's no shortcut. There's no shortcut. I guess one thing all these three pictures have in common: the soldier is upheld by the thought of victory. The athlete is upheld by the thought of the gold medal. And the farmer is upheld by hope of the harvest. There's always a reward when we do that which is right with the Lord. And then there's a last picture. It's as if Paul said, look, if these other pictures don't inspire, think of Jesus and think of him raised from the dead. The victor, verses 8 to 13. If you can't get encouraged by what I've said, just focus on Jesus. And he tells us three quick things as we finish. Number one, risen from the dead. He doesn't mean think back to a historical event. It's not what he's saying. That was true, that happened. But he's saying, think of the risen Christ who is by you day by day, whatever your situation, wherever you go. You are not alone if you are a Christian. You don't carry the memory of Jesus. You are indwelt by the Spirit of Jesus. There's a big difference, isn't there? Friday night over at Locks Heath, there was a tribute act to Elvis. And a guy came out in a very badly fitting wig and a very tight jumpsuit. And he performed before the two or three people who were there. No, there was a bigger crowd than that. But he's carrying alive the memory of Elvis. Elvis is long dead. Unless you believe the newspapers and he's on the planet Mars somewhere. But all you can do with Elvis or Shakespeare or anyone from history is you carry on their memory. But not Christians. Jesus, who conquered death, ascended back to heaven, has given us his Spirit. He is with us wherever we go, says the apostle. And then he says, remember not just the risen Christ, but the one born of the seed of David. That's Bible shorthand. It just means the Jesus who was human. Jesus, yes, may be divine, maybe what part of the Godhead, but he knows when you hurt, because he hurt when he was here on planet Earth. He knows what it's like to be hungry. He was hungry. He knows what it's like to endure hardship. He endured hardship. He knows what it's like to be rejected by people. He was rejected. Whatever your earthly experience, he's been there. So the apostle says, remember the risen Christ. Remember the human Christ. And then thirdly, he says, remember you've got good news, the gospel of Jesus. There is no greater message than the message of Jesus Christ. It turned your life around, says the apostle Paul. It will continue to do that as you follow him day by day by day. So in conclusion, what is the process of discipleship? First of all, we come to faith. Timothy came to faith through the preaching of Paul. Secondly, we're willing to share that faith. Timothy, I entrust the message to you. You entrust it to others. They entrust it to others. Thirdly, we endure hardship. Because as sure as eggs are eggs, it's coming. It's getting tougher all the time to follow Jesus Christ in a society that doesn't want to know. Fourthly, we're to be honest and truthful. I hope each one of us is characterised as trustworthy by our friends and our neighbours. If they tell us something, we're not going to gossip it. We say what we mean. We tell the truth. Fifthly, we are patient. It takes time, especially with people. Angel's not here, but the amount of hours that Penny and others have invested in Angel just to get her and the kids and Chin Hao sorted out when they first arrived years ago is unbelievable. But the rewards are a happy, contented family now able to go back to China. They'll reap the rewards. And then sixthly, remember Jesus, who's always with us. We're never alone. Let's pray. Thank you for listening, and let's commit our time to the Lord.